From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. As experts on animal health and science, veterinarians have a lot to offer in terms of understanding coronaviruses, which are zoonotic diseases, meaning they start with animals. And around the world, veterinarians are contributing to scientific efforts to combat COVID-19. Meanwhile, day to day, the pandemic has meant major changes for New Hampshire veterinary offices in order to keep their human clients and employees healthy, all while trying to run a business and take care of the animals. Today in The Exchange, we check in with two Granite State vets, and listeners, we welcome your questions. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also use Facebook or Twitter. We're talking with Dr. Michael Dutton, founder of Ware Animal Hospital and Exotic Bird Clinic and Hopkinton Animal Hospital. He has an expertise in serving a wide range of animals, including birds, reptiles, and amphibians. Also with us, Dr. Sabrina Russett, owner of Court Street Veterinary Hospital in Keene. She's worked on foreign veterinary projects, including white rhinos in South Africa, street dogs in Sri Lanka. Welcome to both of you. And Dr. Russett, I'll start with you. Given your background in animal health and given that foreign background that I just mentioned, how do you view what's going on right now with this coronavirus, maybe a little differently than your average person, Dr. Russett?
Hi, Laura. Good morning. I think all of this is a really fascinating, emergence of zoonotic disease to study. We do know, I think, in America and the developing world, we have had, a lot of luck in, overlooking or not really having to deal with the day-to-day zoonotic potential of diseases that they do in developing nations. Things like rabies, unfortunately, can be very common in nations where they don't routinely vaccinate for these diseases. So I think it's been a fascinating development to see our response to all of this in a disease that's emerging from an animal population and unfortunately affecting humans.
And a zoonotic disease, Dr. Russett, just remind us, I said in my introduction, it's connected to animals, but you probably have a more professional definition.
Well, so right, it's a disease that starts in an animal population. Whether or not it causes clinical disease in animals can vary widely, but ultimately it's a disease that then makes the jump into human populations. So we've seen these things, rabies, leptospirosis, leishmaniasis are all pretty classic disease processes. The SARS viruses and these coronaviruses, COVID-19 has not been the first that's affecting human populations. And we do know that bats are known reservoir hosts to many different novel SARS viruses. So there's potential likely possibilities that this is not the only outbreak that we're going to see.
Oof. Hate to hear you say that, even though I appreciate your expertise, Dr. Russett, but I have definitely read from others the same thing, that we need to understand this now because there could be others. And Dr. Dutton, I wonder what you think, how you view this time and in particular this zoonotic virus, a little bit differently than your average person.
Well, as Dr. Russett mentioned, this is not the first time. We've gone through the rodeo before. This one just happens to have more global implications. I think our ability to connect to other parts of the world is that we sort of followed it more than we have previous outbreaks of SARS-type viruses and so forth. So I think everyone's just more knowledgeable about it. And unfortunately, this one, even though it's a relatively low mortality rate, it's still pretty shocking, whereas a lot of the other ones, such as swine flu, it came through. We were able to get a vaccine, but I think not everyone knew about it to the detail, and it passed. So as Dr. Russett said, this is an episode. We'll have another episode or more in the future. It's just trying to follow best medicine that we know. And I think some of that's a lot of the problem is we don't know how this is going to play out because it's a novel virus. We don't have a playbook for every virus I think everyone sort of got on board, and I hope that the next time, you know, a lot more things get kicked in quicker. The clients are very knowledgeable about it. Surprisingly, I have very few clients coming in asking whether their pets are at risk. So it has not, that part has not been a big conversation for us in the exam room.
Well, and I definitely want to ask both of you how your practices have changed, what sorts of responses you have been getting from your clients. But another question just about, again, the idea that veterinarians have a lot to offer in terms of helping us understand what's going on right now. Here's an editorial that I came across from a Rhode Island paper. I thought it was real interesting. One veterinarian in Rhode Island outlined her hopes for how we might better understand these viruses, these zoonotic diseases. She says, veterinarians are animal health experts and familiar with how zoonotic diseases work. When they collaborate with human health experts, their efforts can help facilitate prevention and protection. She says the case for cooperative work is urgently clear now, and we must support and encourage it. I thought that was really interesting. And Dr. Russett, to you first, how much of that cooperative work towards prevention and protection do you see going on right now between animal health experts and human health experts?
You know, I think anecdotally, we're starting to see a lot of changes coming in place, and not to say that there's any kind of arrogance or, you know, exclusion of the veterinary profession from, you know, One Health or the medical field, but all of medicine and human medicine is no exception. It's such a dense subject that people tend to get, you know, pigeonholed into their one topic. So when something like this emerges, it really turns the whole world on its head, and we've got to start thinking about these things, you know, with a bit of a paradigm shift. So, you know, to say that we've got things to offer, I think epidemiologically, you know, from a wildlife encroachment perspective, you know, having to respect these viruses coming into play is hugely important. And I think we've got a lot to offer in terms of research in the vet world that is already underway, that's already being worked on, that could then be applied to human medicine. And, you know, one of the most exciting things that I think I've read over the past couple of weeks, and I don't know, Laura, if I could link you to it, if you've not heard of it, but these llama antibody studies.
I had not heard of that. Yeah, go ahead.
So they, you know, researchers have already for the past several years being, you know, looking at llamas, you know, they create antibodies that effectively neutralize SARS viruses. And that research was beginning to, you know, reach the publication stage of that when all this pandemic broke. So those, they went back to the drawing table and, you know, specifically tested these llama antibodies against this particular, you know, COV2, COVID-19, and found that they are producing active antibodies. So the application of, you know, llama cells towards human medicine is something that's showing a lot of promise. You know, things like that, I think, are very interesting and are going to have a wider global health application in upcoming years.
So, Dr. Russett, how much do you see sort of the human health side reaching out to veterinarians, veterinary groups, you know, veterinary scientists and labs, which, by the way, UNH has a great veterinary lab that I know has been doing some work. How much connection do you see going on right now, Dr. Russett?
With this particular pandemic, you know, I think it's happening more and more often. You know, Public Health England, NHS over in Britain has approached veterinary surgeons and asked, you know, can we take stock of your respirators and your ventilators? You know, it's the same equipment that we use in our patients, and they have been able to, you know, borrow equipment when they needed it for the, you know, height of their outbreak. We also, I think in Michigan and Illinois, Ohio have had calls out from the governor saying, you know, put vets on standby. If this outbreak gets bad in our state, then, you know, our emergency and critical care specialists, our internal medicine specialists in this profession, you know, they do a lot of the same work with intubation and managing patients on respirators and even triage and taking vitals. I think it's, you know, not inherently different just because the feathers or the scales or the skin might be a bit different.
Well, well said. And Dr. Dutton, what do you think about the coordination, the cooperation, the working together that should happen, that maybe is happening between human health experts and animal health experts like you?
Well, COVID-19 is sort of a unique situation. Like I said, it's probably not filtering down to the private practice in terms of that cooperation. But I know, because I'm work right outside of Concord, is that a fair number of my clients are human physicians. And when they come in, we have conversations about a bunch of other diseases. Lyme's always up there, leptospirosis, and they're always curious, gee, you know, what are veterinarians doing? And then we have a conversation, this is what humans are doing, and so forth. So at least on a one-on-one basis, those physicians are walking away saying, well, you know, veterinarians, they actually know what they're doing. And, you know, because the regulations on our medications and our testing are smaller, less expensive, is that we have some point of service tests, for example, Lyme disease, that humans really don't have. And to go back to other areas of cooperation, is that most medications there is an animal model for, and most large pharmaceutical companies have some association with a veterinary pharmaceutical company. And the one that I always talk about is there's this heart drug called pimobendan that we use in dogs with mitral valve issues. And it actually started out as a clinical trial because big pharmaceutical companies understand if they can get into the human market, that is where the profits are. And so it works really well in dogs, but unfortunately works very poorly in humans. So we actually now have a drug that humans rarely can use because it just doesn't work on them. So, you know, we have, I want to say, somewhat early access to a lot of medications because of the research, you know, in terms of llamas or anything else, that, you know, there's that cooperation at that level. And like I said, on a one-on-one basis, I think the human physician clients walk away and say, wow, you know, that's pretty cutting edge, which is a nice feeling at the end of the day for veterinary medicine in general.
Well, and just hearing from both of you, it seems like the connections really run wide between these two areas. And it's good to hear that there is more conversation going on. And just lastly on this topic, Dr. Dutton, you've been involved with a global effort called One Health. What is that? And how does that fit into this whole picture that we're talking about right now?
So there's a variety of international and national organizations that are looking at doing the collaboration that we've been talking about on so many levels, and just understand there's a whole ecosystem of animal health and how it links to people health, and vice versa. And it's really conversations that are happening between governments, they're happening, you know, between the American Veterinary Medical Association and other counterparts. And there are classes in it now for veterinary college students. There's numerous continuing education seminars on it. And it gets back to, you know, we're all interconnected somehow. Let's play on the strengths. Let's figure out what the weakness is. And is there another animal or human model that can address that weakness? So it's just opening up a whole collaborative type of network on a variety of different levels. And like I said, it's filtering down to the private practitioners, because you can go, for example, a New England Veterinary Medical Association meeting, I think last year or the year before, had a whole set of speakers on One Health that were from the World Health Organization and so forth. So it's just a massive collaborative activity.
Wow. Well, lots to talk about. And I want to invite our listeners to join us. Our number here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, we're talking with two New Hampshire veterinarians on how the coronavirus pandemic has affected the work they do. And we're hearing their unique view on this threat, given that coronaviruses are so-called zoonotic diseases, largely transmitted from wildlife. Again, send us an email with your questions, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook, you can tweet us, or you can call in 1-800-892-6477. On a more practical level, and Dr. Russett, I'll turn to you first. What types of questions are you getting from clients about possible transmission from animals, from especially their pets?
We've had very few very concerned clients coming in, and you know, although we were starting to see that you know, most of these clients are taking it upon themselves to be you know, the seekers of information, and really they're finding out this information themselves. But occasionally we do have a conversation where we've got you know, very concerned client. They're showing or their dog is showing respiratory signs. Their cat's showing respiratory signs. You know, a little bit of a cough or sneeze. You know, we don't typically have a lot of worry about COVID-19 affecting animals.
The number one concern I've read about, Dr. Russett, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that the human owner gets COVID-19 and isn't prepared to care for the animal because he or she is so sick that, you know, they don't have the right enough medicine for 2 or 3 weeks, they don't have enough food for 2 or 3 weeks. I wonder what message you're sending out to your clients regarding that.
Yeah, I think in all of those cases, you know, having an emergency plan in place for your animals is not something that's COVID specific. It's a great idea. If you're ever so incapacitated that you can't care for an animal at home, then, you know, certainly we can start thinking about having 2 to 3 weeks of food on hand and your pet's medications if they're on them, having a backup plan, somebody that could come and take care of your pet. You know, at this point, we don't have any need or recommendation to say remove an animal from a household that has tested COVID positive. We do know that these animals are not a significant source of infection for humans. You know, there have been rare cases where we've had an animal test positive for COVID. They can contract it, but they're not significantly acting as a, you know, transmission phase for this back to humans.
And Dr. Russett, Dr. Dutton, excuse me, you mentioned you're not getting a lot of questions about transmission either from clients about, you know, can my dog get this from me? Can I get this from my dog? You're not getting a lot of that, Dr. Dutton?
No, you know, it sort of waxes and wanes when the dog tested positive, I believe, in China. You know, for a couple of days we had questions, and then sure. When a couple of large cats got tested positive at the zoo, we got a couple of questions, but it's not on the forefront. You know, with this one, it's probably like most businesses, as the owners come in and they say, oh, do you remember the good old before times, you know, as they're talking through their mask and, you know, they're 12 feet away and or 6 feet away and, you know, the Purell's out on all the counters. You know, and we all say, yeah, it's the new normal, and we move on. So it's not a lot of questions about the infectivity of COVID to the pets.
Well, and that's a perfect segue for what we're going to talk about after a break, because I know the two of you and other veterinarians around the state have had to make big changes in the way that they run their offices. And sometimes clients have questions. Sometimes clients don't like it. So we will talk about how the two of you have had to change the way that you do business. And there's a lot more to discuss as well. We'll take your questions and comments coming up after a short break. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, two New Hampshire veterinarians on how the coronavirus pandemic has affected the work that they do and their unique view on this threat, given that coronaviruses are zoonotic diseases, that means transmitted from animals, largely wildlife. Send us an email with your questions or comments. You can use Facebook, you can tweet us, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. We're sitting down this hour with Dr. Michael Dutton, founder of Ware Animal Hospital and Exotic Bird Clinic and Hopkinton Animal Hospital. His expertise includes birds, reptiles, and amphibians. Also with us, Dr. Sabrina Russett, owner of Court Street Veterinary Hospital in Keene. She's worked on foreign veterinary projects, including white rhinos in South Africa and street dogs and cats and Sri Lanka. One more time, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. And our email, exchange@nhpr.org. www.franklinveterinaryclinic.org. And both of you, Dr. Barry Taylor sent us an email. He's with the Franklin Veterinary Clinic. He says, this is how the Franklin Veterinary Clinic is responding to the demands of the COVID crisis. We call it the monkey cage. Only Dr. Taylor and the patients are inside, with the owners seated around the outside. Dr. Taylor says, obviously surgery doesn't occur here, but exams, blood work, vaccinations, etc. can occur in this environment. Thought you might be interested. By the way, Dr. Taylor sent us a pretty extraordinary photo of this arrangement that we will post later on our website if you want to check it out. Dr. Taylor, thank you for writing. And both of you, Dr. Russett, you first, tell us what some of the basic sort of operational changes are that you've had to make.
Well, I think when the whole thing started to break in New Hampshire and New England back in early March, our initial response to this was, you know, first and foremost, we're changing to a curbside service plan right now. So the owners come, nurses will triage our patients over the phone, do intake, and then the pet will come inside while owners wait outside in the car. Or drop the pet off with us for several hours if it's something that needs more of an extensive workup, and come back later. So that has kind of segued into us doing a lot of telemed, in the sense that we're, you know, communicating, taking histories, dealing with owners over the phone while the pets and our patients come inside, and they're the only ones that we have real direct contact with. The second, you know, business model, I guess if you could say so, was the preservation of PPE. Personal protective equipment for the human medical field. And, you know, in the vet world, that doesn't apply extensively. A lot of the animals that we work with don't pose an inherent, you know, infectious disease risk to us in my day-to-day job. So things like, you know, masks, those N95 masks, we never really routinely use them to begin with. And the things like endotracheal tubes, those in our world are reusable. We re-sterilize them for surgeries and reuse them again, as opposed to, you know, human health, that's a disposable item. My surgical gowns are all fabric, and those are washed and re-sterilized. They're not, you know, disposable gowns like you would have in the human world. But, you know, being really sensitive to the fact that we're saving gloves and, you know, masks for human health. And so we ended up postponing a lot of routine surgeries, things like prophylactic dentals, castration surgeries, spay surgeries, and push those out by several months.
Are you doing those now, Dr. Russett?
We have now come back into mid-May again. Initially, we had said our routine care, our exam vaccines, you know, normal physical exams and castration spays. We had initially pushed those out to, you know, end of May, early June, thinking, surely we will all be back to normal by then, initially when all of this started. So we're starting to see a few of those cases come in with clients that just can't wait. You know, if we're starting to worry about inappropriate behavior in dogs that really do need to undergo that spay or castration surgery, then we'll take those on board then, yeah.
Wow, so you are not back to, you know, full operations as normal,
no.
Dr. Russett.
Yeah. No, not yet.
Well, and you mentioned the masks. And so even though the dog or the cat or the rabbit doesn't pose a risk to you for infection, you and your staff, it sounds like Dr. Russett, are masking up and maybe gloving up too, because anybody who comes to your clinic could be carrying the virus, even if they feel perfectly fine. So it's for human protection.
Exactly. Yep, exactly. So, you know, as is the case in the human world and my world, you know, forefront of people who are bearing the risk for this are my nurses and nurses in the human health field as well. So they're the ones who are approaching clients in the car and taking these animals directly in. You know, we doctors in my practice tend to stay in the back in the treatment area and work through these cases and really just employ telemed. So gloves and surgical masks for those guys are a necessity. And we use them as sparingly as we can.
How about you, Dr. Dutton? What changes have you made in your day-to-day operations? You're running two hospitals and treating all sorts of animals.
Yeah, I mean, our big thing was we, what I like to term, de-densified the number of people in the hospital. So a lot of elective things we stopped. Grooming is probably an obvious one. Boarding was an obvious one. Some of the technician staff things such as nail trims and whatnot. We did away with those. Anything that was pushable off, we did. And unfortunately, the state gave us some guidance saying, you know, it's okay. Yeah, we have these rules, but if, you know, the owner needs a heartworm test for their dog and needs a couple more months of heartworm pills, it's okay to give them a couple more months. So the state was going to go lax on some of their rules and regulations about developing what's called a valid veterinarian client patient relationship. And I agree with Dr. Russett, you know, a big shout out to my staff at both hospitals. They are on the forefront. They've done great. They've put a little humor in the situation when that, let's say, less than humorous client comes in and is having some issues with it. We do a lot of curbside. We did still take clients in, but it was one per family, and they would call from the parking lot, or I should say they are calling from the parking lot, and we would run them right into an exam room to keep the waiting room clear. As I mentioned, masks, ample Purell, and we would try to do a lot of things just out back to limit the contact and the owners. You know, a lot of times if we were doing a blood draw on a dog, the owner would go wait in the waiting room. Well, they get sequestered in the exam room. Routine surgeries we would put off, vaccines we would put off unless they were time sensitive. So, you know,
yeah, because some vaccines still, are, right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The town still required, you know, you have to have your dog up to date on rabies by April 30th to get it licensed. That wasn't pushed off. Although Ware and Hopkinton did not have their standard town rabies clinics this year because of so many people in one place. We still had to do rabies vaccines, or you think about the puppy booster shots or the kitten booster shots. So like I said, a lot of it was trying to minimize the amount of people. Normally we do 20, 30 minute healthy pet appointments. That was pushed out to 40 to 60 minutes a piece. And that would just allow the rooms really to be sanitized. We have whiteboards outside the room and they go in with a particular product that, you know, let it sit for 4 minutes and, you know, they would spray the room down and on the whiteboard, they would say, you know, 10:30, it's okay to use someone in that room, and they'd throw a timer on it or something like that. So it was, you know, sanitize.
That's a lot of extra work for your staff.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's one of those things that, the good news is some of the stuff. So we got my management software. We can use tablets. So we got a few tablets and we were checking people out of the room and we're like, wow, this really minimizes the clutter up at the reception counter. maybe we're going to do this after COVID has passed by. So, you know, it's one of those things that it showed some weaknesses in the processes. We fix those and hopefully there's one or two golden nuggets there. We say, hey, we can continue doing that. Telemedicine, you know, we have clients that would call all the time for updates and whatnot. And especially in my exotic practices, a lot of our clients are 1 or 2 hours away. We were already telemedicine them, you know, take a picture, let's have a conversation. You know, my budgie hurt its toe. Do I need to bring it in? You know, and oh, by the way, I live in Sanford, Maine.
Wow. Yeah.
Now let's have a conversation first. So the telemedicine wasn't a big thing. And telemedicine was loosened a little, but within veterinary medicine, you still needed to have that valid patient client relationship. So if you hadn't seen the pet, you couldn't prescribe anything. You couldn't diagnose anything. If you had a pet that had a new problem, you really probably couldn't diagnose it. Or prescribe anything via telemedicine. Now, if you had that Labrador retriever that had chronic ear infections and they want to refill on medications, sure, we can telemedicine that.
Sure, it's something you used to do.
A lot of times we did already before COVID. So, yeah. You know, telemedicine didn't really impact us tons because we were sort of doing it anyways.
Yeah. Well, I have a bunch of emails that I want to share with you. But again, I want to remind listeners, you can give us a call too. It's 1-800 8926477. If you visited your veterinarian lately, what was that like for you? Also, if you're one of the many Americans who adopted a dog or a cat recently because you're home during the pandemic, tell us about your experience with that as well. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Got an email here I want to share with both of you about customers and how they've been adapting or not adapting in some cases to these new rules. This person says, my husband is a veterinarian in New Hampshire, has been practicing for about 30 years. I would like to remind your listeners that these doctors and their staff are essential workers and have been putting themselves and their families at risk to continue working and help pet owners and pets. The curbside and other restrictions are there to protect all of us. Our receptionist had a woman yell at her and call her an incredibly rude name, swear at her, then hang up, only to call back later and still try to get an appointment. We have had people show up without masks and multiple people come even after being asked to come with just one person and that masks are required. This person says, it has been said to the point of getting old, but we really are in this together. Please do not put my husband's life and all of our family's lives at risk. And wow, there's so much to unpack there. And Dr. Russett, you first, have you had clients be incredibly rude, like this woman who yelled at the receptionist and swore at her? Also pretty gutsy to call back and ask for an appointment later after you behave like that. Have you experienced extremely poor customer reactions?
Rarely. And, you know, unfortunately, yes, I think the vast majority of our clients have been hugely trusting and appreciative of us continuing to be here. And really, my team and I focus on that and those people above all else. And I think a lot of people who are reactive to this or hesitant to this, really, it's coming from a place of fear and anxiety. And they, you know, maybe don't know me. They haven't met me in the exam room five times. You know, they don't know the practice as a well-established practice yet. And I can appreciate that it's terrifying to look at your dog who maybe is nervous going to the vet anyhow and trust that he's walking in without you. So it takes a massive level of trust in us to continue to do our jobs and let these pets, patients come into our hospital. And so that I appreciate above all else. And in the, you know, rare occasion where we do get some pushback and somebody's not comfortable with proceeding, then, you know, certainly that's their prerogative. And our response to those people who have called and refused to comply with these new regulations and these new protocols that we have in place, at this point, we're telling them that, you know, we'll offer you an appointment in September and October, and it's under constant review, but hopefully we'll be back to normal operations at that time. And then we can reassess and come up with a game plan.
So, Dr. Russett, if someone doesn't want to come in with a mask or absolutely insists that they be at their cat's side during a certain procedure, you say, I'm sorry, you'll have to find another veterinarian, or you can come back in, you know, October when hopefully we're able to be a little bit more open. Is that what's going
exactly
on for you?
Yep, exactly, exactly. And, you know, unfortunately, it's always an uncomfortable and unfortunate situation to have to tell somebody no. And it's not because we're being difficult. It's not because I invented this pandemic. Everybody is in this and suffering through. So to have had some of these attacks become personal about us or our practice or the way that we're doing business, really has been disheartening and unfortunate. But again, the vast majority of people have been supportive and appreciative and trust us to do our jobs.
Wow. I wonder if the woman, when she called back after she'd been so rude, tried to use like a different voice, you know, just so they wouldn't know it was her. How about you, Dr. Dutton? Have you gotten negative reactions from clients?
Oh, very minimal. Again, most of our clients, they understand the situation. We're doing a lot of telephone calling. This is how the appointment works. I totally understand it. I think the gamut of clients is going to be the same you read about in the newspaper, right? You have the ones that are extremely afraid and they're staying in their house, all the way to ones that are like, you know, life is normal and, you know, I'm going to meet, you know, 500 of my friends on the beach. You know, we just see it and we just try to have the conversation. For us is that we sort of have that rapport with most clients that, you know, if, when Mrs. Smith calls, it's one of those things you take a different tone with Mrs. Smith as you would as opposed to Mr. Jones, because you understand, you know, their personalities a little. And again, you know, kudos to the staff on knowing the clients that well, that they're able to say, hey, not a problem. We'll come out and we'll get your cat in a carrier and we'll bring it in. Whereas Mr. Jones wants to bring in his dog and we show him right in the room. You know, I guess some of my chuckle is, you know, I have the clients that like they understand the 6 feet, but my exam room's only 10 feet long and they just won't stay in their corner. You know, it's like, yeah. Can you just sit? We'll take care of everything. It's like, well, you know, I want to point this out to you. And it's like, you know, you can just describe where it is and I will find it on your pet. Just stay over there. And they're not doing it on purpose. They just want to be really, really involved with their pet. And, you know, that's what all veterinarians do. We want, you know, owners involved in their pet health care. And now we're sort of saying, well, like, you know, everything we've been telling you for all these years is great, but you need to sort of keep your distance now. And you know, some clients, they love their pet so much. And, you know, great.
Well, and as our emailer said, it's not just you and your staff. It's also the family of the veterinarian, him or herself, and also the family of the staff who works at the clinic. I got another email. This is Pam in New London who says, I have enormous respect for veterinarians who must diagnose and treat various types of patients who cannot explain what is happening to them. We pet owners realize that cats are not little dogs, hamsters are not little cats, and so on. Some veterinarians also treat large animals like horses and farm animals. Especially in this world of specialty medicine, those expensive lab results are so important. We humans often have insurance to cover costs, but few carry pet insurance. So a veterinarian needs a vast knowledge of signs and symptoms to recognize an issue and how to treat the patient on their table with the correct treatment or medicine for that species. Pam says, I love this, hats off and paws clapping to all of them who could have chosen a much more lucrative human medicine future, but instead struggle to save our very treasured companions. Pam says, by the way, few human physicians must also deal with frightened, powerful patients who can be dangerous when in pain. Pam, what a great email. Thank you for that one. Thanks also to the person who emailed earlier with that pretty disheartening story. We'll take a lot more of your emails after a short break. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And coming up, we'll talk about what have been called pandemic puppies and COVID kittens. Lots of adoptions going on. So we'll hear about that. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, New Hampshire veterinarians are fielding lots of questions these days about animal health during the coronavirus pandemic, and they've really had to change the way they do business. We're talking about that and hearing their unique view on how COVID-19 has developed, given their expertise in animal science. Exchange listeners, we welcome your questions. Have you visited the veterinarian recently, or have you wanted to but weren't sure if you could or should? Also, if you're one of the many Americans who has adopted a puppy or a kitten during this time, tell us about that. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can comment on Facebook, you can tweet us, or you can call in 1-800-892-6477. Joining us for the hour, Dr. Sabrina Russett, owner of Court Street Veterinary Medicine in Keene, and Dr. Michael Dutton, founder of Ware Animal Hospital and Exotic Bird Clinic, and also Hopkinton Animal Hospital. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. So both of you, and I think I'll turn to you first, Dr. Russett. I have a friend who adopted a pandemic puppy and said that four people in her neighborhood had also adopted puppies. What are you seeing, Dr. Russett?
A lot of the same. We've had, a significant increase in new puppy and new kitten appointments coming in, which of course we do keep because it's important to maintain those vaccination schedules for these new babies to make sure that we're getting immune protection from animal-specific diseases that we're protecting them against.
So that is an appointment that you will do because they need that boost from the outset, Dr. Russett.
Exactly. Yep, exactly. So we, routinely vaccinate our puppies against, distemper and parvovirus, both of which can be relatively ubiquitous in dog environments. It's something that's very important to protect them against when they're at those early baby stages.
And do you have any concerns about this surge in adoptions, Dr. Russett, or do you think this is great, more people connecting with pets?
I think it's great. And I think, probably what, the insinuation is when the world is, quote, back to normal and everybody's back to normal life again and working jobs, what happens to these puppies? And one of the things that we had discussed coming into this is whether or not we're going to see a reflex increase in shelter animals and animals being surrendered, in 6 to 8 months. I'm not convinced that that's going to be the case. I think, a lot of people are probably looking at this as a time to take advantage of where they're home all day. We can get through, the main housebreaking and the main training phases with these animals, really invest a lot of their, early socialization milestones and, get these dogs and cats, behaving in the way that we expect them to within homes. And hopefully we'll find that they're staying in their forever homes.
So it is a good time then, perhaps, to do this, Dr. Russett, because you do have the time to do those important jobs when you adopt an animal that you might not have had earlier.
I think so. And the ASPCA back in 2013 had a really interesting study on this. They surveyed, 5,000 or so animals and, discovered that the ones that are being returned to shelters, only the quote, not enough time for this pet at home applied in about 10% of cases. So, the vast majority of animals are surrendered for different reasons, things like allergies or moving situations, can't take my animal with me. The landlord changes the rule, something of that nature. And while, we kind of joke on the inside here that the dog population is never going to forgive us for all going back to work, and missing out on our 3-hour daily hikes with all of them. really, I think that, investing in these animals during these, first three to five months with them, training, housebreaking, all of that is hugely important. And now people have the time to do it.
That's kind of funny. I've got a friend who walks his dog in the park a lot, and the dog has been, let's just say, a little chunky. And then I saw the dog recently. I thought, wow, your dog looks great, because it's getting walked all the time. Dr. Dutton, what are your thoughts on this surge in adoptions that we've seen?
Oh, I agree. Way back when, as I used to be the president of the Animal Rescue League, and it was one of those things that on the shelter aspect, we always tried to make sure that that puppy or kitten was well matched with the owner. And that's still occurring. So I think these owners that are getting the puppies and the kittens, they're matched up. It's not sort of a spur of the moment thing. It's not like the shelters are sitting there and first come, first serve. I strongly have to believe they're still doing their due diligence, getting good matches, making sure that the resources are there on the owner's side. And I think, in this time, having a puppy or a kitten is a good thing just from a mental health perspective for the owners. And like Dr. Russett said, it's a great time for a puppy or kitten because you're getting them socialized. I agree the dogs are probably going to miss the owners. And, the cats are probably like, hey, could you get back to work because you're interrupting my nap.
Just for the record, our cats seem thrilled. That may be me anthropomorphizing a bit, but they seem thrilled. But there is that very funny video that was circulating a couple weeks ago about the cat that was absolutely not happy that its apartment had been taken over by the owners. What's been the hardest for you about this whole thing, Dr. Dutton? We talked about, having to curtail services and the new procedures you've had to put in place and sometimes clients not being happy with those new procedures. What's been the hardest for you, Dr. Dutton?
I think it's just the tension, and you're seeing it everywhere. I mean, how many times are you going to the grocery store now and you have your mask on and you're going one way down the aisle and you're just keeping your eyes down? You know, it's hard because the clients are coming in, and just sort of that facial expression and having those conversations. You know, people, some are scared, but, you know, there's a lot of apprehension, fatigue, burnout. You know, it's just, it's a little more somber to be at work now. And it's just, but that's everywhere.
Yeah. What about, Dr. Dutton, euthanizing animals? I mean, that's, you know, a moment that everybody remembers if they've gone through it. What's that like for you now?
We're still allowing the whole family to be in for the euthanasia. It's one of those things that, you know, we're really promoting one person per appointment, but, you know, that's just a big exception. We at both buildings are fortunate that, you know, one of the exam rooms is right by an entrance door. So, you know, we're just sort of getting them all in. We really haven't changed that much. One of the things we have changed, we've really stopped doing house calls. And, you know, that was probably about, I don't know, 50-60% of our house calls were in-home euthanasias. And you know, just from a staff perspective, I can't control what you're doing in your house in terms of clean and all that stuff. So those have taken a hit, but in the hospital, business as usual.
Yeah. How about you, Dr. Russett? What's been the hardest part of all this for you? You know, euthanizing animals, when you have to, have you had to lay off staff? Have you had people yell at your staff like we heard from that earlier email? What's been the hardest part for you?
I agree with Dr. Dutton. I think overall there is, you know, a huge mass amount of tension that's really affecting everybody, you know, not just specific to my industry or to our pets and patients, but really we're seeing that we're having to work, you know, probably 20% harder at telemed and client communication and education in order to, you know, really achieve the same results with a case with animals. And it's so important that we do this extensive communication with these guys. So, you know, really what in the exam room might have taken, you know, 5-10 minutes to explain because we've got handouts and diagrams and, you know, in-person explanations, we've really been challenged with the limitations of just talking over the phone and, you know, trying to supplement that with emailing and sending, you know, PowerPoints or handouts, PDF files about a specific disease process. But even doing that, you know, leaves an unfair onus on many of these owners to kind of digest that information on their own and then come back to us with any additional questions. So that's been a huge challenge. And, you know, in terms of euthanasias in my hospital, we are unlucky in the sense that my exam rooms are, you know, incredibly small. It's just not safe to have people inside the building right now because it's so tiny. But we have had, you know, a little table that we've put out back in the outside in the yard, and I've tried to make a nice spot shady by the trees so that we're able to mask and gowns and gloves and go outside and allow the owners to stay with animals. I agree. I think that's you know, one of the most sacred experiences that you have as the owner of an animal or, you know, the pet parent of an animal, is to hold their paw while they're going through that, and not to wax eloquent about it, but I think it's a massive responsibility that we have in the veterinary world. You know, you don't see the same kind of problems in the human world regarding euthanasia specific considerations. But we really are trying to honor that in whatever new and different ways that we're able to right now.
Wow, lots of adaptation. It's tough. And David wrote us on Facebook on this topic. David says, we felt a lump in one of our dog's abdomens. We called the vet. They agreed to see her. We drove to the location, called the office. A tech came out to get our dog, and I described the problem. They took the dog inside, and we waited in the car. So this sounds like this is what you guys are doing, too. The vet called us and said, we found the lump. It's just a soft, fatty deposit. These are quite common. It could be removed if you want, or we can keep an eye on it. The tech brought our dog back, and we drove home. It was all a little strange, but it worked out fine for us. But David says, if there had been a significant issue, I'm not sure how I would have felt about making life or death discussions over the phone while sitting in the parking lot. Wow, David, you know, I hear you. And what do you think, Dr. Dutton? You know, when an owner is faced with these life or death decisions and they are so deeply connected to their animals, you kind of want that caring vet, you know, sitting with you in the room. I remember these discussions myself as a longtime cat owner. So go ahead, Dr. Dutton. What do you think about David's comment?
Every situation is unique. Like I said, we're allowing one client in with pets. So that is not a big issue with us. I do have some clients who don't want to come in the building. And hey, you know, they've sat in the driver's seat with the window down, and I've stood about 10 feet away, and we've had a conversation in the parking lot.
Sure.
You know, when it's big like that, you know, we're doing everything we can to accommodate. You know, the weather's nicer, I'm sure I'm going to have a lot more parking lot conversations than, you know, when it was 28 degrees out. But yeah, if you need a face-to-face, do it outside, more than 6 feet away. That's pretty doable by everybody.
Yeah, it was probably tougher, Dr. Dutton, earlier, right? I mean, it's hard to believe now, but it was really chilly this spring. It snowed in April. I think it snowed in early May. So at least now the weather's better. But those parking lot conversations must have been tough for you when it was snowing.
Well, that's what coats are for. So
there you go.
You know, it's one of those things. We have great clients. Everyone sort of, you know, chuckled. I'm out there in a coat and a baseball cap, and the owner's in the car with the window open, you know, and the rain's going one way or the other, you know, and we have a conversation and, you know, have a good chuckle. Everyone's doing pretty good. There's tension in there and there's a few outliers, but most of our clients are taking it in stride and doing a great job.
Well, we got an email from Anna, who is one of those people who adopted a puppy. She says, my husband and I adopted a now 11-week-old Australian Shepherd Border Collie mix. I am now teaching from home, and my husband is an essential worker. We'd been planning to get a dog at some point, but didn't have the time. And now I have more time to be home, and the summer is perfect puppy training time. Anna says, we went to the vet yesterday, and it broke my heart not to go in with him. But the tech was amazing and explained everything to me before she came out to get him. The vet called and spent 15, 20 minutes letting me know everything I needed to know and what appointments to set up. Anna says it was nerve-wracking, but it was settling to know how thorough and caring the vet and techs were. Anna, I'm glad you had a good experience. And just a couple last questions for you. And Dr. Russett, you first. Just about everybody I've talked to in the last 2 months, you know, no matter what field they work in, says, we're going to do things a little differently once this is all over. And how about you, Dr. Russett? Are there practices or approaches that you would actually like to hang on to?
Yeah, you know what Dr. Dutton was saying earlier, I think adding telemed is going to be something that we're going to find really valuable. A lot of our clients are elderly and, you know, are probably going to be homebound or facing restrictions for a lot longer than the general population. So provided we've seen these pets before and we do have that client-patient relationship, I think adding the advent of telemed and send us a picture and let's talk on the phone. And if you're more comfortable doing that, then we're going to work our hardest to roll that into the practice. It really does have limitations. It can't work all of the time. You know, if it's a new concern or, you know, you're telling me that your cat is drinking more water, well, there's, you know, five different things that might be the issue there. So, you know, we really are still having to see these patients face to face and get hands on them. But I think overall people have been massively appreciative of the work that we're trying to do here. So.
Sure. Well, and how about you, Dr. Dutton? You mentioned earlier a couple, I think you called them gold nuggets that you are going to hang on to.
Well, you know, I agree that telemedicine, we have a lot more conversations with owners from just a logistics point of view, you know, checking owners out of the room, getting them right in the room, doing a lot more stuff in a quiet 10 by 10 room, as opposed to trying to have that conversation up at the reception counter where there may be, you know, three or four other people and barking dogs and so forth. So I think how we move clients from entry to exit is just going to look a little different. I think the client's going to appreciate it. It's not going to be a fix for every practice because it's really dependent on the number of exam rooms you have. If you have a few, you can't do it that way.
Well, it's been really good to talk to both of you, and good luck as you continue to carry out this important work. I really appreciate you being with us. Dr. Dutton, it was really interesting to hear from you. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
That's Dr. Michael Dutton. He is founder of Ware Animal Hospital and Exotic Bird Clinic and Hopkinton Animal Hospital. And Dr. Russett, it was great to talk to you too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Sabrina Russett, owner of Court Street Veterinary Hospital in Keene. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. And our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our fellow is Jane Vaughn. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Thanks for being with us. I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individual, not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.